Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Ant Pruitt joins me, Micah Sargent, yet again for this episode. We start things off with Dr. Techlash. That's right, Neerit Weisblatt joins us to discuss AI. But don't worry, this is a conversation about, you know, if you're feeling like there's too much going on with AI, if you're hearing it left and right and trying to make sense of when it's scary, when it's not, should we be scared? Why should we be scared? Or why should we be excited? It's trying to find that middle ground when it comes to AI. Then I have two stories of the week. First, about the legal history of the emoji, as well as a story about Tesla workers who are reportedly have been sharing video and images from Tesla vehicle cameras of its customers. Then Sam Abul-Samid joins us to talk about not only that story, but also several other EV car stories, including more about Tesla. Stay tuned for this episode of Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 280, recorded Thursday, April 6, 2023.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Dell Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, which deliver a more personalized user experience with adaptive AI-based software that boosts collaboration wherever your team works. Learn more at cdw.com/dellclient. And by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts today, Micah Sargent.
And I am Ant Pruitt. How you doing, sir?
I am doing well, Ant. It's good to have you here again for another episode of Tech News Weekly. I believe Jason Howell will be making his triumphant return next week, but it's been great having you on the show for a few episodes.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, man. It's been a lot of fun and been able to talk to some fascinating people as well as go through some really interesting stories these last couple of weeks in the world of tech. And today that's no different because, you know, we've been talking about AI here at Twit again, but I wanted to do a bit of a different spin on it, you know, because with the world of AI from a tech coverage standpoint, so you're going to get a couple different perspectives. You're going to get those folks that are just gung-ho and just really super hype about AI. And then you're going to get the side that is gloom and doom and telling you just how horrible and how problematic it is. And I've yet to been able to find a interesting balance of the world of AI as far as the coverage goes. But today I wanted to bring on one of our great friends of the network, Dr. Neerit Weisblatt. She's also known as Dr. Techlash because she has a book called Techlash where we're looking at how everyone is just with their claws out against big tech. And sometimes it's worthy and sometimes it's not worthy of all of those claws coming out. But Dr. Neerit is here to talk about what's going on with AI and what we like to call some AI doomers of today. Dr. Neerit, how are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here.
I appreciate you joining us today. This story, I went back and saw a former story of yours over on Tech Dirt. But what really got me interested is a couple of your recent tweets here online. You've had a lot of fun with the folks out there. But let's first start with the story back on Tech Dirt, which is headlined, "Overwhelmed by all the generative AI headlines. This guide is for you." And you touch on a lot of different things going on from like the tabloid standpoint with how AI is being covered and how AI is being discussed. Can you dive into that a little bit more for our listeners and viewers?
Of course. So what I'm showing there is that our AI panic now is unprecedented, but it's not new. So the way the media is covering AI has decades of different panic, but it always you know, capturing this emerging technology in a way that it's either too utopian or too dystopian, and it moves from the most promising thing for humanity and productivity and, you know, other industries to it's going to kill us all. And as you said correctly, not a lot of middle ground here. So not a lot of balance or nuance or something sane. It's mainly either going to save your lives or going to kill and wipe out humanity. And the problem with this is that if it was only, oh, it's a good picture here, like the Daily Star. So if it was only the British tabloid saying attack of the psycho chatbot, that was fine because it's funny and you expect this type of, you know, sensationalism from them, right?
Very tabloid like.
Yeah, and this tabloid, its front page was followed by a different headline says psycho killer chatbots are confused by Wordle. So yeah, they have fun. They just have fun with this, which is fine. It's funny. The same tabloid, but my point is, I'm a communication researcher, so I'm looking at the like legacy media, traditional media, prestige news outlets, and they publish the same level of you know, populist BS and create this mass AI panic hysteria because they, you know, just give stage to the loudest, most insane critics. So the New York Times gave stage to, if we don't master AI, it will master us. The op-ed by Tristan Harris, Yuval and Harari and Azar Raskin. And the Time magazine of all places gave stage to, be willing to destroy data centers by airstrike. You know, Eliezer Yudkowsky. So with the help of mass media, this AI doomerism is moving from, like we had the petition, the letter about governments should, you know, enforce a 6-month pause to something that is just an insane, batshit crazy discussion about we should bomb data centers. Now, why do we see? How, why? I mean, and then you ask the why question, right? And I think that the right background here is that AI panic is a good marketing tool. So Sam Altman of OpenAI, for months now, since like DALL-E, like first launches products, told us again and again, like really frequently, that we should all be scared of the coming super intelligence, AGI, artificial general intelligence. And because it has so much, you know, magic powers, the worst case scenario will be light out for all of us. Oh, and now you need to ask, okay, if you're developing this thing that you're super nervous about and every interviewer said you're scared of it. And I emphasize with people who are a lot of, you know, afraid and scared of it. Why? Right, and then I think that the right question is that it serves him well that all of us think that it's this magical, powerful thing that they're being developing in their place, right?
But
it's good for future employees. It's good for investors if your machine is this magical, super intelligent force.
Okay, so it's definitely a marketing ploy, whether we like it or not, because one would assume that the teams behind these different generative AI platforms could come forward and say, hey, look, it's not all bad. It's not all good. It's somewhere in between. But yet that's not really happening because it's,
I can tell you that with Sam Altman, the interesting thing was, okay, so I think it was January when he spoke like for 2.5 hours with this lady from a VC that worked in TechCrunch. So 2.5 hours, he's talking about the benefits, productivity, revolutionized education and industry and wealth and creativity and whatnot. The last question was, okay, so after all, you know, 2 hours of good things, bring me some worst case scenario. And then he said the lights out for all of us, right? Sentence.
Right.
What do you think the headlines were from this interview? All the headlines were OpenAI CEO says lights out. Nobody listened to the 2.5 hours that he said actually good, balanced, nuanced, smart things that are beneficial for society. The media is a part, is an actor in here in making this peak AI hysteria Because spreading it, it's also good for its business. This is why Time Magazine takes someone like Eliezer Yudkowsky instead of not giving him stage and giving stage to Nuance, actual AI researchers that actually knows what they're talking about. He does not. He's a sci-fi lunatic.
Okay, so it's good for the business of those journalistic platforms, whether it's New York Times or Time Magazine or who have you. But that's not good for society, right? That's just creating, that's going to potentially create angst amongst all of the people reading those headlines and the people that are not necessarily reading those headlines and tabloids, but hearing about it outside of, you know, just at the local watering hole, if you will. Well, man, did you hear about this AI? This thing is going to take over the world. This can't be good for all of us, right?
Yeah, so my problem with those AI doomers, which I characterize, and we can talk about it later, is that at least with Sam Altman, you say, okay, at least he produces products to the world. He does actual influence. My problem is with the all AI doomers that creating this AI panic is their product. It's their career. It's their source of money. So look at Tristan Harris that I mentioned, or Eliezer Yudkowsky. All that they do is talk about AI is going to kill everybody and wipe out humanity for their own good, for their lectures, for their centers of humane technology, for their books, for their whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And their integration with the media is the toxic one. And I can understand if you have an AI researchers who are going to bore the audience with nuanced, logical, smart take about the state of this technology, I don't know if it's so interesting as someone who's going to yell, it's going to kill everybody.
All right. Right. So tell us a little bit more about this tweet that I have here. How to spot an AI doomer, make up fake scenarios in which AI will wipe out humanity.
Most of them, it's what they do.
Gary Marcus here is
actually, I don't think he's qualifies as a doomer. I want to clarify that.
Okay, great.
You need to have all criteria, and he does not meet all criteria.
So what are all of the criteria that you would like to list under an quote AI doomer? Someone that's going to...
Yeah, so after we mentioned like people like Tristan that's saying that this, we summoned an alien intelligence, a godlike power who's going to ruin our humanity, culture, creativity, and at the end wipe everybody off the planet... This is the type of people that I'm thinking of when I'm talking about AI doomers. Not the ones who actually say, this is our logical problem that we see today with, let's say, misinformation or deep fakes or things that I raise the alarm when I in TechDirt talked about the AI generated art tools. So the thing is, those AI doomers are distracting us from the real problems because they have apocalyptic imaginary scenarios fantasy in their mind. So the way I characterize it is, yes, they make fake up scenarios. They don't even bother to have any evidence to back up those scenarios. It's just hypothetical questions. Should we develop something that will replace us and kill us? No, it's just like, why is that the question and the basic for a petition? Like, they clearly watched and read too much sci-fi. They're all speaking the same language from the same books, from the same Terminator, Skynet, world of thinking about the world. Again, they said that the AI's godlike power should be stopped. And the chosen ones can stop it. And this is where it bothers me because it's very paternalistic, elitistic. We are the superior ones. We have the knowledge about this super intelligent thing that you, the public, the little scary, hopeless people that don't have our intelligence, you can't handle the AI. So let us tell you what should be done. And for that, give us money and we'll tell you what should be done, which is just ironic, right?
Wow, such a scam. So let me ask you just point blank, Dr. Neerit. Generative AI, be it ChatGPT or whatever OpenAI is offering, MidJourney, Stable Diffusion, all of these different platforms and offerings out there. Is it okay? Is it good to use? Is it bad to use? Or is it just totally fine?
Okay, so again, we should have a nuanced discussion. Yes, it has tons of potential harms. Again, some of that I raised early on.
Yeah.
we need to mitigate those, to put a lot of safeguards, which, again, I think the letter, the petition ignores what the companies are actually doing to put safeguards. Mm-hmm. Their human reinforcement, the feedback, that they're really thinking about ethics and safety from the beginning, and not, we can think on any other technology that everybody's thinking really thorough about the safety from day one. So, right. I'm optimistic that we can handle it. We can, you know, edit it, change it, find our norms around it. It will have mm-hmm. uses. It will have misuses like any technology. The panic is just distracting us from the real issues.
So getting AI right, if you will. I hate really saying that, but getting it to
nobody knows more, what right really means. But
yeah. Right. But getting it more to where we can consider it safe, if you will, or not necessarily something that's going to destroy us as human beings. You think we're a year away in time before things are a little bit more normalized with AI, generative AI?
No one knows, because things move so fast. I think it's part of the problem, the speed of things. It's so overwhelming that I understand why people are afraid of it. It is overwhelming. Right. I'm a subscriber of, like, I don't know, 10,000 newsletters about AI, and every day brings like hundreds of new startups and applications and uses and misuses and things that happen. Like, we need to digest a lot of things, and it will take time. But I'm hopeful that we can get it to be just more beneficial to us than hurtful.
Right. Well, Dr. Neera, this has been a fun and interesting conversation with you. I really do appreciate you joining us today. Where can we find out more about the things that you're researching and writing and covering here in the world of AI?
Dr. Techlash.
Dr. Techlash. Got it.
And you'll find out.
And also, you want to tell us briefly about your book?
Sure. So as a communication researcher, I'm analyzing the tech discourse for the past 13 years. So I started when it was all positive and cheerleading and glorifying the tech companies. And then it switched to the tech lash, the big tech lash against big tech. It was mainly about social media ruining democracy, targeting ads and things like that. So I analyzed the coverage of the big tech companies and also the companies' crisis responses, their PR efforts to, you know, respond to all the criticism in the media. And it's an ongoing story, because now with the AI panic, it's like a gift that keeps on giving. Because, right, we moved from analyzing social media that's ruining democracy to, instead of user-generated content, it's now AI-generated content that's going to ruin democracy.
Of course.
Please notice of the reoccurring things here. And we are back to from visuals that was last summer to text to big tech, because we started the arm race now, right? So the tech is like this cycle of things that's happening, and then the backlash in the media. So my hands are full. I have a lot to analyze.
Yeah, you're going to be quite busy, quite busy. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Neera. I really do appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Up next, we've got the first of my two stories of the week, but I do want to take a quick break to tell you about our first sponsor. It's Dell Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. We're bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. The people at CDW get that your unique workforce has unique needs for their devices, especially as we all continue with hybrid work. It's a challenge for IT to supply devices that can meet everyone's needs everywhere they work so that they can stay connected throughout the day. Luckily, CDW can help custom configure Dell Client Solutions devices for a more personalized user experience. What this means is that your workforce gets adaptability for performance with AI-based software that learns how your team works and optimizes workflows. And check this out. Dell Client Solutions devices have intelligent noise detection and cancellation, along with high-quality video that adjusts with your lighting. Pretty amazing, right? This fleet of devices is really great because wherever your team works, its built-in security responds to malicious attacks, providing a secure way to boost collaboration and productivity from anywhere. When it comes to seamless experiences, Dell Systems makes adaptive performance possible CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Dell Client. And thank you, Dell Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, for your support of Tech News Weekly. All right, back from the break, and there is a fantastic story that I think is well worth reading over on The Verge from Sarah Jung, who has reported on the poop emoji. So the poop emoji has made a recent return to the limelight, or perhaps the... Never mind. We'll go with limelight. Has made a return to the limelight. Thank you. Because of Elon Musk, as you might imagine. So there are a couple of ways. First, when we saw the poop emoji make an appearance in court, but also because some of my fellow journalists who have sent requests to Twitter's sort of PR line, in many cases are receiving in return just the single poo emoji as a response. And so this is kind of ha-ha, funny, et cetera, the way of Elon Musk. But what was interesting is the reporter over at The Verge decided to look into kind of the history of how this particular emoji has made its appearance in court. And the first time, as far as the report can determine, was in 2018, when there was a case in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals with Emerson versus Dart. Emerson versus Dart was a corrections officer who essentially sued the county in the area for workplace discrimination. And while this was going on, the individual, the corrections officer, was in a private Facebook group and had posted something, a little message in this private Facebook group saying, in part, "So glad that the arrogance of this employer has them believing their own poo emoji." So that ended up being part of this this actual court case, and it didn't end up going to trial. So there was not the conversation between lawyers about how they were going to talk about the poop emoji and say it out loud, what they would say exactly. But it is something that's well worth kind of looking into, because we also saw the poop emoji kind of displayed in Elon Musk's tweet in response to the then Twitter CEO. And during that whole period of time where Twitter was looking, or where Elon Musk was looking at acquiring Twitter, and Twitter was sort of doing their due diligence, and then there was an agreement that Elon Musk would not disparage the company, and then Twitter ended up... Remember all this that took place? It's wild. Mm-hmm. Twitter ended up suing Elon Musk for disparagement, and that poop emoji was one example that Twitter's lawyers had for this potential disparagement. But a single poop emoji on its own is kind of hard to interpret, at least when it comes to the law. So
right,
we looked, or we
have to know the full context of things.
Yes, exactly. And without that context, you could make the, I mean, Elon Musk could make any sort of argument for what that poop emoji could mean. And we've seen that with different emoji, right? This is
right.
A very common thing where we see emoji being used in means that run contrary to what one might expect, where among certain groups, an emoji might have a different meaning, where, you know, you might interpret an emoji a certain way. You send it to somebody and they don't see it that way. And then there's even just like individual disagreements. So there have been some researchers who have looked into emoji and its sort of effect on law, because of course, as time goes on and as internet communication continues, and as the use of emoji only climbs, we are seeing more emoji make their way into court. And so there needs to be a conversation among lawyers about how to go about handling this. Because when you think about, sort of, for a lawyer, much of their work is, well, depending on the lawyer, much of their work is about data gathering and historical understanding and precedence. So they are looking through previous court rulings and trying to make arguments based on how different court cases in the past have turned out. And so there needs to be now, if we're going to have emoji, and this is going to be part of the conversation, there needs to be an understanding of how these emoji are handled. So there are a couple of research articles that The Verge links to, one from Eric Goldman called Emojis and the Law, and another report from Jennifer Behrens for Duke Law School called Unknown Symbols, Online Legal Research in the Age of Emoji. And both of these pieces, right? It's a super fascinating stuff. And I've linked to both of them, and we'll have those if people want to check them out. They talk about, of course, emoji in general, sort of what they're used for, but then misunderstandings, and even going as far as to talk about emoji dialects. And I find this incredibly fascinating because
emoji dialect.
Yeah, which is a great way of sort of thinking about emoji. In the same way that the English language has multiple dialects. Well, many languages have multiple dialects. Depending on how you're using the language and the context of it, it can have different meanings. And the same thing applies to emoji. So I wanted to make a quick comparison. For the longest time, there has been an ongoing discussion about the way that dialects can and have impacted certain court cases. African-American vernacular English is one example where that dialect of English is has its own, as many dialects do, its own set of grammar, usage, and mechanics, its own set of ways that you communicate. And particularly when it comes to tenses. And so there are times where a person in court who speaks with African-American vernacular English has said something, and due to sort of the legal system's method of sort of sanitizing language and in many ways kind of taking context away from it, it has led to a misunderstanding about what someone was testifying to or how what they were actually saying versus if they had the context and the understanding of the dialect, it could mean a different thing. And I'll, you know, folks, if you want to look into that yourself, you can. There are a few.
John McWhorter has brought that up on several occasions. John McWhorter is a linguist that was, I don't know if he's still here or not, but he used to be at Cal Berkeley. And he has brought up a lot of different instances regarding Black English versus what happens in the court of law, and how sometimes it could be misconstrued in time, just as you said, based off of, especially with tense, not tension, but tense as in time. And it was pretty fascinating. John McWhorter is another one.
Yeah, that's, and I think, in fact, that was the exactly who I was thinking of, because it does discuss, there's a New Yorker article about McWhorter, and there is quite a few links in this New Yorker piece that talks about that very specific thing. So I want to draw that comparison in the sense that at all times our language is changing. And even if sort of the basis of English isn't changing, the way we communicate is, and that's kind of what these folks are saying, these law researchers are saying. And it goes on from just sort of this standard conversation about how, you know, haha, funny that lawyers are trying to figure out ways to talk about the poop emoji. It goes even more than that, though, because the researchers, Jennifer Behrens in particular, who teaches at Duke University, in Jennifer's study, she was looking at how these law libraries, these digital libraries, in many cases just completely forego displaying emoji, or in some cases provide just sort of references to the emoji. So there was a piece, and I'm actually just going to read from the introduction of Jennifer Berent's piece, because I think this is, it exactly sums it up. In April 2018, an entry in the Kansas Bar Association Journal's regular, called Substance and Style, legal writing column, was entitled simply, and then it's three of the thinking face emoji. Three thinking face emoji icons adorned the issue's table of contents at the top of the article, whose author examined the proliferation of emoji in legal evidence and the associated problems with varying online displays and reader interpretations. The entirely graphical article title included an explanatory footnote. In text, this essay might be called Thinking About Emojis. But, and now I'm paraphrasing, when this was sent to these online legal research services, thinking of like LexisNexis, Westlaw, Gale, One File, Legal Track, all of these different online libraries, many of them just completely ignored the title and did not display that title. Some of them just went with calling it Substance and Style, which is the name of the column. So it did not have that exact representation. And some of them sort of tried to explain that the title was three emojis or emoji. But in every case, the bigger problem is that if a lawyer then has a case that involves a poop emoji or another emoji, and they're trying to look back and find some precedents or find how other court cases sort of worked out, you can't just type in an emoji as it currently stands. And you, in many cases, can't even do something like thinking face emoji and come across the piece that you were looking for, because these online libraries are just like, an emoji, we can't handle that. Well, I don't know what to do about it. So they just give it a name that sort of works. So the technology needs to change as much as a sort of legal understanding surrounding these symbols that many of us are using now. I find this entire thing fascinating. And I have to be honest, like I had not considered the legal implications of something, because I'm so used to, I can remember working at a journalism publication where we were, you know, doing our normal headlines. And then at one point we thought, oh, it'd be so great to do an emoji in this headline. And so I asked, hey, can we do an emoji in this headline? And the person directly that I was asking sort of got these big eyes. And then they were like, oh, we've got to ask this person to go to that person. And then we're going up. We're, you know, basically filing a support case. And I mean, it just went up the chain until finally, and it was off the chain, and it finally made it to where we needed it. And the person was like, I don't know if we can do that. Let's try it and see if it breaks anything. I don't know to this day if we can do that on Twit's content management system. Right. I don't know if we've ever tried it. Because it's one of those things again.
Like, where in the world is Unicode in all of this? Where is Unicode and where is Jeremy Burge? Is
that Burge? Yeah, Burge.
Burge. Jeremy Burge. Where is he on all of this here? There needs to be some type of evolution, and fairly swiftly, because it seems to be the norm of people communicating with emojis and rather, you know, just random text messages amongst themselves. But heck, even in day-to-day work chat, it's so easy for us to slap a emoji in the Slack to communicate a job being done.
Yeah, you can quickly answer by doing so. And that's the thing too, is like, this is the whole point of the Unicode standard, is you have a set of code points that a computer, a server, like anything can read and then in turn display, because it exists as a code point that all of the different computers can understand and all the operating systems can understand. And they can all go, okay, that's exactly what this is, and then display whatever's available. But in some cases, they don't have the ability to display whatever's available. And I also have to say, and then we'll wrap things up here, in Eric Goldman's research, one of the things that Eric talked about was the way that proprietary artwork can be an issue when it comes to emoji, because I think a lot of people they're becoming more aware, but in some cases aren't aware that the way that an emoji is displayed with Apple's devices is different from the way that it's displayed on an Android device, is different from the way that it's displayed on Twitter, is different from the way that it's displayed on Facebook, because the Unicode group, they do a very specific thing. And in fact, it's the sort of sub body of the Unicode group for emoji and the subcommittee. And they provide a name for each individual emoji. They provide a description for that emoji. And then in many cases, they provide a sample artwork for that emoji. But any operating system that reads Unicode and displays characters based on Unicode can choose to display that icon in the way that they see fit. And so that's why you get different examples of emoji, and sometimes those have different understandings. And so with that desire to set oneself apart in terms of proprietary artwork, Goldman argues that that also plays a role in the confusion that exists when it comes to legal grounds, because the poo emoji from Twitter might look different from the poo emoji on Apple's platform, might look different from another one.
Right.
The poo emoji on Twitter is pretty goofy. It's got huge eyes and a big old smiling face versus some of the other ones where it's just a poo. And some that also have faces. So yeah, it's
one could be interpreted as chocolate soft serve.
Yes, exactly. I just sent ice cream. It doesn't matter that it has, you know, this or that or the other. Anyway.
So is there like a starry night emoji out there?
I think they call it sparkle.
Wow. I know so little when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah.
I never even thought about the fact of putting proprietary work as an example to further explain what said emoji is, but I guess that's what it takes, though.
Yeah. And I mean, that again, with Goldman's argument, it's like, so Apple has a team that designs, so they look at the name of the emoji, they look at the description of the emoji, they look at their set of emoji that they already have, and then they design the artwork for their version of that emoji. Google has a team that does the same. So they're trying to match their own library, and in doing so, you get these variations. I understand what you were saying now. I thought you were just asking if there was like a star emoji. When I said proprietary artworks, I was more talking about, and Goldman is talking about, how every company that has their own emoji library, those artworks belong to that company. So proprietary in that sense.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So like Twitter, they own theirs. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. They don't do it like, you know, instead of doing the sparkly stars, they decide to just display, what is it? Van Gogh's Starry Night. So
Starry Night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But wow. In any case, I think this is a really interesting conundrum that I had not considered, because there's already sort of just in general life, this back and forth, I think, between generations in particular about the use of emoji and should we be doing it? And so in some cases it's like, oh, it's a repeat of history because we have hieroglyphics as part of our conversation. I like it as an augmentation of our language, as an opportunity to add more potentially to what we're saying in a smaller bite-sized package, rather than having to, in some cases, type everything out. Or as you're pointing out, it's very easy for us to communicate the things that we're trying to say in Slack and get our point across by responding with just a simple emoji, rather than going, I saw what you said, and that is great, and I am giving a thumbs up in real life. And we're done.
I'll say it's easy-ish, because there are times where I'm confused if someone is giving me a high five or if they're praying for me.
Oh, yeah. But that's the thing. Depending on who you're talking to, it means one of those other things, because that was originally supposed to be it was not even, if I remember correctly, it's meditation. Not even prayer hands originally. It's like hands like, placed together and you're sort of bowing and you're saying,
namaste.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of. I don't remember exactly what it is, but right. Like no one is using, well, some people are using those hands pressed together as prayer hands. Some people are using it as high five. Some people are using it as namaste. It all has different meanings to different folks. And that's the argument here, that we have to consider that, especially when it comes to law. But that is going to have to bring us to the end of this conversation. So I will thumbs up emoji, sparkle emoji, and the wind blow emoji, because it's time to move on. Up next, I've got
farting.
See? Oh, Lord have mercy. But I do have another story of the week coming up, but I want to take a quick break to tell you about our second sponsor today, and that is Bitwarden. So I think it's incredibly important that you out there have a password manager. And given that Bitwarden is bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly, why not check it out? Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. Even our very own Steve Gibson of Security Now, who has switched over. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. You can protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. So if a bad actor gains access to one account, they don't suddenly have the password for every single site you have added an account to on the web. And then I love this about Bitwarden. You can go further with the username generator so that you're not even using the same username across sites. You can create unique usernames for each account or even use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Email aliases are the new awesome, because it means that for each individual site that you visit, you've got one email that essentially gets sent back to your actual email address. And that way, if one of those sites that say, "We never sell your personal data," sells your personal data, you can very easily narrow in on and figure out which site it was that did that, because you've got a unique username, a unique password, and a unique email for every single one of your accounts. It's brilliant. Bitwarden also has new features to announce in their latest February release. This includes significant updates to the key derivation function encryption. So that's a lot of words that mean your encryption of your passwords and sites and everything is a lot better. Bitwarden accounts will use 600,000 KDF iterations for PBKDF2 as recommended by OWASP. So again, it means that everything is a lot more difficult for a bad actor to get into your encrypted vault. Argon2ID is also an option alternative to KDF for users seeking specialized protection. A stronger master password has a higher impact on security than KDF iterations, so you should have a long, strong, and unique master password for the best protection. So regardless of the KDF iterations that you have, you can turn those up, but make that master password very difficult for anyone to guess. And it also has master password security checks. New users who create their accounts on mobile apps, on browser extensions, and the desktop apps can now check known data breaches for their prospective master password via Have I Been Pwned? Then you can log in with a device, which is now available for additional clients. Login requests can also be initiated from browser extensions, from mobile apps and desktop apps. Basically, Bitwarden is constantly adding the latest in password and security options to make sure that you are staying secure online with the best and sort of strongest technologies that are out there. You can share private data securely with coworkers. You can share across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans, because Bitwarden has the Teams organization option, which is $3 a month per user, and the Enterprise organization plan, which is $5 a month per user. Of course, individuals can always use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords. Upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 a month. Really good pricing. Or you can bring the whole family organization option to give you up to 6 users with premium features for only $3.33 a month. At Twit, If you haven't figured it out by now, you should know we are huge fans of password managers. We are evangelizers of password managers. It's so important. And Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, of teams, and organizations worldwide. So get started with a free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. Thank you, Bitwarden, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly and for keeping so many people safe online. All right. My second story of the week is a rather concerning report from Reuters talking about Tesla. So Tesla vehicles have, and I know we'll be talking about Tesla soon. Tesla vehicles have cameras on them. And part of the reason that they have cameras on them is to help with the self-driving functionality, with some of the sort of lane detection, avoidance detection, all of the magical stuff that's supposed to make your car driving experience a lot safer and just to help you become more aware of what's around you. And as the Reuters article points out, you know, Tesla has long talked about how the privacy of its users is very important, and that the cameras in the vehicles are, quote, designed from the ground up to protect your privacy. However, according to Reuters, who spoke with they say several nine former employees of Tesla. Between the years 2019 and 2022, there were groups of Tesla employees who shared videos and images recorded by the Tesla vehicles, the cameras on the Tesla vehicles of some customers. And they would share these on an internal messaging system. So along with sharing some photos, some videos, they would share crashes, road rage incidents. Reuters says that there was one recording that involved a video of a man approaching a vehicle completely naked. In some cases, the videos were or photos were of people's interiors. So once the car was parked in the garage, then those images and videos were there. They would take these images, these videos, and sort of make them into memes, add captions to them, share them around internally. And while Tesla vehicles no longer do this, there was a point where you could opt in to having the cameras basically running at most times, even whenever the car was turned off, so that the whole point was your car would kind of be watched even when you weren't around it. And just to make sure that it wasn't being broken into, or if it was broken into, then you'd have that evidence. That is no longer a feature. But when it was, Reuters said some of the video appears to have come from times when the car was turned off and that feature was enabled. There was one really interesting story that is part of this piece. And I'm going to read a little bit from the article because I think it's the best way to summarize it. Okay. About 3 years ago. Oh, go ahead. Did you have a question?
Oh, no, I was saying, okay, go ahead.
Oh, cool. So, quote, about 3 years ago, some employees stumbled upon and shared a video of a unique submersible vehicle parked inside a garage, according to two people who viewed it. The vehicle was nicknamed Wet Nelly. The submersible, rather, was nicknamed Wet Nelly, the White Lotus E-Sprite or E-Sprit sub that had been featured in the 1977 James Bond film, The Spy Who Loved Me. There's one person who, as far as we know, had purchased for about $968,000 this unique submersible vehicle and who owned it. That person was Elon Musk. So employees viewed the footage of Elon Musk's own Tesla to see into Elon Musk's garage, to capture this image and to share it in internal messaging, in the internal messaging system. And as Reuters points out, it's not clear whether Musk was even aware of the video or that it had been shared with people.
The first argument some people would say was, how do we know that was his car? You know, you just tapped into some random camera in the database. You don't know that was Musk's car. Well, stuff like that is personal identifiable information right there. And could clearly just start to connect the dots. You know, everybody's not going to own a $968,000 car. You know,
there is
a record of who does own a $968,000 car.
Wow. And that was the other thing, too. In many cases, they didn't have the Tesla said that even in the before times, whenever they were recording this video regularly, and even to this day, if the video that is being captured is shared with the system that kind of tags these videos to figure it out, Tesla says that it's separated and anonymized so that they don't know who the video or the photos are coming from. However, there were two things that these previous employees pointed out. One, in some cases, the video and the photos, while it didn't have people's names or like their Tesla account or anything like that, it did have location information. And so that can be enough to narrow in on a person. And then, because there were distinct items like this submersible, then that also could point to a specific person. So it wasn't entirely the case that they didn't, or that the information was completely anonymous. But I think kind of the bigger conversation here talks about how much of these videos, these photos, it used to be that they would send a lot of this information off to human beings in Africa. They employed, we've even talked on this show before about how companies will hire out to different countries the process of tagging data for an artificial intelligence engine and to help it better understand, this is a person, this is an ice cream cone,
this is part of the terms of services. Once you purchase a car that says, you know what, well, you're going to analyze some data that's coming from your car, do you opt in? I've asked a similar question about purchasing a Tesla when it came to full self-driving or FSD or whatever it called. There had to be something in the contract regarding what you're signing up for. And I wonder if the customers even knew what they were signing up for, because there's no way they just willy-nilly doing this. They had to have this on the contract and figuring they can cover themselves from the court of law if someone says.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Is the images, the videos were that were supposed to be sent over for the sake of tagging. And again, I say sent over because Tesla in 2016 had employees who would label those images for pedestrian street signs, et cetera. They would have access to all of this stuff, and then they would view and identify the objects. But over time, Tesla has started to automate the process. So they ended up closing down a lot of those sort of hubs where they were doing this. And despite that, there are other folks who still do work for Tesla, specifically doing that labeling. But I want to quote again from the Reuters piece. Two ex-employees said they weren't bothered by the sharing of images, saying that customers had given their consent. There you go. That people long ago had given up any reasonable expectation of keeping personal data private. Three others, however, said they were troubled by it. So one was saying, I don't care because we all know that nothing that's out there is private. And then there were some who said, well, they opted into having this information analyzed. Sure, they opted into having the image analyzed, the video analyzed, but analyzed does not include turning it into memes that you share amongst friends to have a laugh about. Yeah, no one, right. I feel, reasonably expects that that's going to be part of analysis.
Yeah. So, you can have it shared on your internal network amongst your colleagues and have a laugh about it. But there is going to be one. There's always one that's going to put that thumb drive in. Let me have this for a copy for myself and put it on my social media. You know that's happening. Oh, God.
And I think that this is where the conversation surrounding sort of spirit of the law versus letter of the law comes into place a lot, because any human being is, even when they, you know, they consent to, again, having their data analyzed, is not expecting that this means that my nude body that walks in front of a Tesla camera is going to be laughed at in a private group. You may learn that and go, oh, I probably should have expected that. But you don't, hearing those words analyzed and tagged for metadata, blah, 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 that's not the same thing as, right. You know, again, it made fun of. So I think that ultimately this is an opportunity. This Reuters report is an opportunity for folks to, once again, sort of recalibrate their expectations for how we should consider our online privacy, and in particular, consider the cameras we have around us, the sensing technology we have around us, all of what's involved with that.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Mr. Sam Abu-Samit was going to join us momentarily to talk a little bit about some cars, but your story is quite fascinating. You think we can have him chime in regarding your story today?
Yeah, Sam, if you've got some thoughts that you want to share about this, I'm curious to hear, firstly, if you are at all surprised that this is going on, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about how those cameras are meant to work in a Tesla, and how maybe the use of it to spy on people's garages and even in some cases show video of children being hit by cars is not what folks signed up for.
Hey, Micah and Ant, good to be with you again. Yeah, I joined in, joined the Zoom in the middle of the conversation and pulled up the story you're talking about. To be honest, unfortunately, I'm not at all surprised that this is happening.
Oh.
It's happened before. It happened, I think, with Ring a few years back. Ring employees somewhere in Eastern Europe that were doing similar thing. You know, they were tasked with doing labeling and annotation of video data from Ring security cameras, the doorbell cameras. They were sharing some of the video content that was being captured by these cameras. So in this particular instance, you know, this first to what you were saying, Ant, earlier about, whether customers agreed to this. I haven't read the full terms and conditions of the Tesla connectivity agreement. But in mm-hmm. general, I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that when you agree to have connectivity in your vehicle, as part of that agreement, you are agreeing to share some of that data with the manufacturer. And they use it for, most manufacturers use it primarily for product development to understand how
customers are using vehicles. Yeah, that's what I thought. They're trying to make it better down the road, right?
Exactly. And, so it's imperative on the manufacturers to have some controls in place to make sure that anybody that within the company or within their contractors that has access to this data isn't misusing it. Now, to the specifics of this particular, of what's going on with Tesla, Tesla's got kind of an unusual situation, because in most cases, for most manufacturers, most new cars have at least some cameras mounted on them for their driver assist systems. Every new vehicle built since, I think, 2016 has a rear backup camera. Most vehicles have forward facing cameras. Many of them have surround view cameras that when you put the car in reverse, or you maneuver around at low speeds, you can get that bird's eye view so you can see what's mm-hmm. around you. And that's really really handy features to have. In almost all cases, as soon as you turn off the car, all those cameras turn off. The computers turn off. All that stuff turns off. And so nothing mm-hmm. can be recorded. It sounds like, from reading the Reuters story about this, which I'm assuming is probably the one you're referencing, or
yes.
maybe another mm-hmm. one, what was happening here is the employees are looking at data that was captured from Tesla's Sentry mode. Tesla offers this additional mode called Sentry, which is basically a surround view security camera system for their vehicles, an anti-theft anti-vandalism thing. So when you turn on Sentry mode, your cameras, the eight cameras that are around the car are on all the time and recording. I think, you know, there's a buffer. So, you know, it's like other security cameras. So they're not capturing all the data all the time because they don't have enough storage space, but they're looking for things that, you know, anything that might be a security issue. You know, somebody seems like they might be trying to break into the car or, vandalizing the car, then, you know, it will record, you know, some amount of video, you know, from the Ring buffer. And, you know, I'm guessing that the individual who was captured, walking around naked probably had their Sentry mode turned on in their Tesla and walked through the garage, hopefully walking through the garage. you never know. I mean, depending where they are,
exactly.
If you've got a fairly private, you know, property and driveway, who knows? You know, that's up to individuals. But at any rate, they probably had their Sentry mode turned on and it captured them in proximity of the vehicle. And then uploaded that data, to Tesla's servers. And then, you know, labelers were, you know, saw that. And then that's where the problem started with abusing the data. Tesla, you know, like other companies, you know, particularly for Tesla, they capture, you know, a lot of short snippets of video that, they, you know, are nominally using to improve their autopilot and full self-driving software. When they find scenarios that the system is struggling with, you know, it's capturing, you know, a few seconds of data and uploading that. And then the labelers go through. And as you mentioned, Micah, they've gone to more and more automation of that labeling process. But even with automated labeling, there still has to be, for at least a significant portion of it, somebody going through and doing quality assurance checks to make sure that the automated labeling is being done correctly. So in many cases, even when it's automatically labeled, there's still going to be humans looking at it. And eventually, at some point in the chain, there are going to be engineers that are going to be looking at those video clips to decide, okay, is this something that is actually relevant for us to add to our test suite, to our simulation suite? Even with automation, there's still humans that can see this stuff.
Yeah. Thank you, first of all, for your quick thoughts on that. And in fact, we may, go on with that after we do take a quick break, because there's lots more from Sam Abulsamid about all of the news surrounding electric vehicles and Tesla and everything else. So I did want to take a quick break to tell everybody about Club Twit. If you haven't heard about Club Twit, well, you should join the party at twit.tv/clubtwit. When you head there, you can become a member of the club, starting at $7 a month, $84 a year. And when you do, you get some pretty great stuff. First, you get every single Twitch show ad-free. So it's all of the content, none of the ads, because you, in effect, become the sponsor of the program. You also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events, and access to the members-only Discord server, a place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. Along with that, you get some really great Club Twit exclusive shows. You get access to the Untitled Linux Show, which is, as you might imagine, in a show all about Linux. You get access to the Hands on Windows program from Paul Thurrott, which is a short format show where Paul Thurrott shares tips and tricks and guides for everything Windows. You also can watch Hands on Mac, which is my program that has tips, tricks, and guides for the Mac, for the iPhone, for the iPad, and everything in between. And you can even watch the newly announced program from Scott Wilkinson. Newly returned program from Scott Wilkinson, Home Theater Geeks, which is a great program. All about making the most of your home theater experience. So please consider joining the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. And thank you to all our supporters out there for your help in keeping us keeping on. All right, let us round things out with our final interview. Ant, take it away.
All right. So today we, again, as we already saw, we have Mr. Sam Abu-Samad joining us because there's been a couple of headlines regarding the world of electronic vehicles. And you know what? I read these stories and wanted to know a little bit more about it and didn't really know who else to ask other than Mr. Sam Abu-Samad because he knows this stuff, man. So, Sam, good to have you back on. I appreciate you joining us today. The first story that came up in my feed is VW and Redwood, according to TechCrunch, VW and Redwood want to turn your old laptops into EV batteries. And I saw that headline. I'm thinking, when it's an old laptop, that thing is done. It's most people will run a laptop into the ground as fast as they try to run a car into the ground. Just use it up and it's nothing left of it. But apparently that's not necessarily the case with the materials. Can you dive into this a little bit more? Is this really something feasible? Our laptops can really be useful for the world of EVs and EV batteries?
Oh, absolutely. And what they're, you know, in this particular instance, what they're doing is they're taking the batteries, the dead batteries from laptops and, other consumer electronics devices as well. Redwood collects a lot of consumer electronics devices, to recycle the batteries, because a lot of the same materials are used in the batteries that are in our phones and our laptops, our tablets, all the other devices that we use on a daily basis. You know, when those batteries get to the point where they won't hold a charge anymore, mm-hmm. you don't want to throw those into a landfill. There's a lot of useful material in there that, and you know, we're talking, you know, billions of devices that are in use there. Mm-hmm. Obviously compared to a car, those batteries are very small, but you know, if you collect enough of those, you can recover materials like lithium, graphite, cobalt, nickel, aluminum, copper, all of which go right back into new EV batteries. And, okay. You know, as we grow the continue to grow the number of EVs that we sell every year, you know, we've got to build a lot more batteries. And, you know, there's two places where you can get the raw materials. You can get it out of the ground, mm-hmm. which is what they've mostly done up until now, and actually you can also recover the materials from the depleted batteries, end of life batteries. And so that's what they're doing here. And as, you know, EVs are still relatively new in volume. Most of the EVs that have ever been built have been built in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So most of them are still on the road. But if we look 5, 10, 15 years out from now, there's going to be an increasing number of EVs that are going to be reaching end of life. And, you know, to your comment about, you know, running laptops into the ground, fortunately, most of our vehicles last a lot longer than most of our consumer electronics devices.
Mm-hmm, they do.
And so it's, you know, it's going to take a while before we start to get a large volume of EV batteries to recycle. But even those, when those vehicles reach end of life, those are going to go to recyclers like Redwood Materials and Li-Cycle and Spears New Energy Technologies. And there's a few others that are starting to scale up, recycling. And fortunately, it turns out that with lithium ion batteries, you can recover about 98% of the most valuable materials from those dead batteries.
Wow.
And reprocess it and put it right back into the production stream for new batteries.
Wow. That's amazing. And with it being put back into place, I guess it's the same consideration when we recycle plastics and paper. You know, yep. You get a piece of
even more so
paper. Yeah. You don't even know that it's been recycled because it's still just the same quality. So we're not necessarily going to see a degrade in battery quality because it's a recycled battery for EVs.
In fact, it's actually more of the opposite. What they've found, you know, they've been doing recycling for a few years now. It turns out that the recycled materials actually tend to be of higher quality because every time you go back and re-refine it again, more of the impurities in there get taken out. And so they've actually found that the performance of batteries made from these recycled materials is often somewhat better in terms of the energy capacity and the power they can produce compared to virgin materials that have just come out of the ground and been processed.
Wow, that's awesome. Good stuff. Well, I appreciate you enlightening me on that. Now, my next headline, this one comes from the folks at Engadget. And this reminded me of a previous conversation that you and I had in Club Twit, because we did an AMA several weeks ago. regarding EVs and so forth. But the headline reads, California will require half of heavy truck sales to be electric by 2035. Now, in our previous conversation, Mr. Sam, the batteries was the problem when it came to these big, heavy rigs, big rig trucks out there. Is they got a number one, they're going to be carrying a lot of cargo weight. That's the first thing.
Uh-huh.
Next thing is the battery itself is going to be just ridiculously heavy with weight. Where's the feasibility in this for this mandate to be out here for 2035? Or is it just they're saying, you know what, by 2035, we'll probably have the battery technology more on par to not be as heavy? Or what's the deal here?
I think they're counting on a bit of both. You know, obviously they're assuming that between, you know, over the next, we're in 2023 now, next 12 years, the battery technology will improve significantly from where it is today. And it almost certainly will. You know, it's been improving on a steady basis for a long time now, and it will continue to improve. But I think, you know, one of the keys here is, you know, they're talking about half of the trucks being electrified. And when you actually look at the use case, and this is something that my company at Guidehouse that we've done, you look at the volumes of the unit volumes of the number of trucks and how they're used. A lot, you know, the long haul trucks, which I think we talked about during that AMA, you know, the trucks that are running, you know, from the port of Los Angeles, you know, across the country or into the middle of the country, running, you know, thousands of miles, or, you know, at least many, many, many hundreds of miles a day, and often, you know, upwards of 1,000 miles a day. Those trucks are going to be more challenging to convert to electric. Mm-hmm. But they also account for only 14% of all the commercial vehicles on the road that are sold annually. So okay. they have the most miles, but they're, you know, relatively small in terms of unit volumes. Most of the vehicles that we're talking about here are vehicles that are operating in local and regional runs. You know, so all of those big UPS and FedEx vans and the day cabs that are, the semis that are not the long haul truckers, you know, they're running maybe 100, 200 miles a day, you know, that are delivering stuff from, Walmart distribution centers to stores, you know, or, other things like that. And those that, you know, aren't having to do long haul, we're already starting to see those trucks coming to market, from a number of manufacturers. You know, obviously, you know, Tesla has delivered a handful of their semis to PepsiCo, and, you know, they're doing longer trips, but with lighter loads, you know, carrying potato chips and stuff like that. But so there's
that would
also
be the balance for now, right?
Yeah. But there's also, you know, a lot of trucks from companies like Volvo and Daimler, and other truck manufacturers that are already coming to market with battery electric. And, you know, those are used for runs, you know, where they're driving 100 to maybe 150 miles a day. And so they can get by with a much smaller battery. So that's those, you know, they account for the vast majority of all the trucks. And so I think it's probably not totally unreasonable that we could get to half of the trucks, you know, half of the commercial vehicles being electric by the mid 2030s.
Wow. Didn't think about that. Now we can combine that story with the previous story as far as recycling the batteries. Maybe that's another way of getting closer to that goal of having half of the fleet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be recycling, you know, longer term is going to be a key part of getting more domestic battery production, you know, of feeding the raw materials into these plants. Right now, there's over 20 new EV battery plants that are either in operation or under construction. I think our tracker right now, we've got about 750 gigawatt hours of annual battery production that should be online by about 2026. And we'll need about double that to go to 100% electric for all the vehicles produced in North America. But yeah, that's a really good start. But that's going to take a lot of materials, and recycling is going to be a key part of that, whether it's for small vehicles that you and I drive every day, or for, you know, delivery vehicles and heavier trucks.
Right. Now, this last headline, this one also comes from the folks at Engadget. Tesla sets a new company record after delivering more than 422,000 EVs in Q1 of 2023. I saw that headline and I was like, really? How? Because based on everything I've ever heard about Tesla in the last 2 to 3 years or so, people are really against Elon Musk. So that means they're really against Tesla. And they're like, I'm getting rid of my Tesla, or dang it, I hate, I just bought a Tesla and I'm going to sell it and blah, blah. You know, there's a lot of that kind of chatter out there. But I guess where it really matters is people just want something that's going to be efficient and good for the environment. And Tesla seems to be leading the way. Is that so?
Yeah. So it's important to keep in mind that these numbers, these are Tesla's global delivery numbers. Unlike most automakers, Tesla doesn't break out their sales for different regions. You know, here, you know, we get manufacturers, you know, that talk about how many vehicles they sold in the United States, how many they sold in Canada, and get similar numbers in Europe and other markets. Tesla doesn't do that, you know. So those of us in the business have to kind of go through other means to figure out, okay, how many of these were sold in the U.S., how many were sold in China, and China is the biggest market for Tesla. Probably I would guess, you know, of these 427,000 total deliveries that they had in Q1, it's probably. At least half, maybe 60% of those were in China. And the rest were split primarily between Europe and North America.
It was roughly 150,000 or 100,000 in North America. Is that a good standard? Is that a good mark for them?
Yeah, I mean, they are still the top seller of EVs globally, but the top seller of EVs in North America. They're in Europe. I think the last numbers I saw for Europe, they're about fifth in terms of EV sales, and China, they're about fourth or fifth overall. And China is the biggest market, the biggest automotive market globally. And they sell, you know, they sell a lot more EVs there than we do here.
Who's number one for EVs in China?
BYD, which is a company that doesn't sell vehicles here in North America yet. There's been some discussion about them coming into the U.S. market, but they are biggest. And there's a number of other Chinese brands that sell a lot of vehicles there. Tesla does well there. They sell a lot of vehicles there. What we're seeing with Tesla is, you know, as EV sales continue to grow, Tesla's sales are also continuing to grow. But they're getting a smaller market share, a smaller share of the overall EV market, because a lot of other companies are introducing new EVs. Here in North America, in 2020, Tesla's share of the EV market was, I think, about 82 or 83%. By the end of 2022, it was down to about 65%, because they're getting a lot more competition. So they're still selling more. They're growing their sales, but they're getting a smaller slice of a bigger pie.
All right. That makes sense. That makes sense. So if you were to look into your crystal ball and say, here in North America and the U.S. in particular, who's going to end up leading this race, you know, over the next couple of years? Is it going to be Tesla, or is it going to be someone like Ford?
It's going to be interesting to watch. As I said, Tesla is still number one here in North America and in the U.S. We've seen in recent months they have slashed their prices pretty significantly, as much as 20%. While they don't like to talk about it, there's clearly been some slowdown in demand. One of the things, I'm not sure if it's mentioned in this particular article, is, every quarter Tesla gives a forecast of how many vehicles they expect to build and sell that quarter or that year. And Tesla came up short on their projections. They did a little better than some of the analysts projected in terms of sales, but they came up short of their own projections. And that is, you know, probably one of the big reasons why they did cut their prices so significantly in the first quarter of the year. They, you know, probably still sold somewhere in the neighborhood of about 150 to 160,000 vehicles in North America, but their sales growth is slowing down. It's not growing as fast as it used to. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of consumers have decided that, you know, they don't want to do business with Elon anymore. And there's a lot more options now. I think, you know, if we look out, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, there's a good chance that Tesla won't be the top seller of EVs anymore in North America. They're already not in Europe and China, but they probably won't be number one in North America either. Who will it be? It's hard to say. You know, Ford is targeting sales of 2 million EVs a year in North America by the end of 2026. GM is on a similar pace. So that's a lot more EVs than Tesla has ever sold in a year in North America. So we'll see. And there's, you know, every major manufacturer is rapidly trying to convert plants and build new battery plants so they can sell more EVs.
Wow. For Mr. Sam, this has been a great chat with you. I really do appreciate you coming on and breaking these stories down for someone like me and helping me get a better understanding of it all. Where can we find more of your musings and work and analytics, if you will, regarding the world of auto?
My day job is with Guidehouse Insights. So you can find the work that we do there, our reports that we publish, our blogs that our analysts write at guidehouseinsights.com. You can also find me on Forbes Autos. Just look for my name on there. I write some stuff there. And of course, you can find myself with Nicole Wakelin and Roberto Baldwin every week on the Wheel Bearings podcast at wheelbearings.media.
Oh man, I love Roberto. He's hilarious.
He's great. Hilarious. Yeah, it's a great group to chat with about cars every week. We have a good time with it.
Outstanding. Well, thank you again, Mr. Sam. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and Micah.
All right.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday. Just go to twit.tv/TNW to find out more about the show. That's where you can subscribe and look at the video versions, or just subscribe for the audio versions and check out all of the show notes and all of the stories that we talked about each and every week. And spread the word there.
If you would like to follow me online, check out the work I'm doing, you can head to @MicahSargent on many a social media network, or you can go to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to many of the places I'm most active online. Check out, if you are a Club Twit member, Hands on Mac a little later today. Sunday, you can watch Ask the Tech Guys. I've got another special host joining me this week. And on Tuesdays, you can watch iOS Today, which I record with Rosemary Orchard. And this coming Tuesday will be a very special episode. Jason Howell should be back next week, so he will be here with us at that point. And Ant, why don't you share your social medias and your show?
Sure. Give me a follow on social medias. I am Ant_Pruitt on pretty much all of them, even our twit.socialmastodon, just Ant_Pruitt. And I'd love to connect with you all there and chit chat here and there about some interesting stories in tech. But better yet, how about y'all go check out my show, Hands on Photography? It airs every Thursday, roughly 3 p.m. Pacific, somewhere in that area. And that's twit.tv/HOP for Hands on Photography, where I'm going to help you get better at photography and post processing, regardless of your skill set.
Beautiful. Thank you so much to John Ashley there in the studio, Burke there in the studio, for helping to make sure the guests sound great every time they are on the show. Thank you again to John, who makes the show possible as the producer, and make sure we sound and look good. And also to everybody else who happens to be working on this show. Sometimes it's Sean Salonina, sometimes it's Anthony. I mean, it depends. But we thank you all for that. And we will see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Goodbye.
If you love all things Android, well, I've got a show for you to check out. It's called All About Android, and I'll give you three guesses what we talk about. We talk about Android, the latest news, hardware, apps. We answer feedback. It's me, Jason Howell, Ron Richards, Wintuit Dao, and a whole cast of awesome characters talking about the operating system that we love. You can find All About Android at twit.tv/AAA.